Yeah, so let's pray. God, surround us with all that is light and loving and good. Infuse us with that holy power, which we name here as the Christ, we know in Jesus Christ. And all that is good and loving and holy emanate from us in all that we do and say. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. I'm going to read to you from 1 Corinthians, and oh my gosh, is that small. Okay, here we go. You might, I had them in my, they're in my bag, I'll be fine. You might recognize this, If I speak with the, right, glory. All right, glory. If I speak with the tongues of angels, if I speak with the tongue of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we now know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. And when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. And when I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways, mostly. That's not in there. I put an end to childish things, ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly. For now we see in a glass darkly. But then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide. These three things. And the greatest of these is, there you go. The 15th century Persian poet Hafiz, he said he had a poem called, "The Subject Tonight is Love." And I think it goes something like this. The subject tonight is love. The subject tomorrow night is love. The subject every night is love. Until we die. The way he put it, the subject tonight is love. So who am I? I'm Mike Hegeman, you know. Oh, sorry, you can see that, right? I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. I've been coming to camps for 35 years now. So I was not born. No, I mean, it's, you know, I was 16 years old when I started coming to camp. So a little bit about myself. Who am I other than you? Those who have been here the last 3 years, any point, you've seen me as song leader. I do have a degree in music education. So that's part of what I do in my life is music. The other part of what I do is I do? I work currently for a Presbyterian church. I teach adult education. I have 13 years of seminary education under my belt. So that's a lot of seminary education. I tutor in biblical Greek, Hebrew, and I teach Latin. So though I have all knowledge but not love, I am nothing. I am a preacher. I have a doctoral degree in preaching. It's called homiletics. That's the way you give the homily. So I'm a professional at this. But that's just to assure you, this will go okay. But but this is a different animal, you know, being up here. So one of the things, though, is sometimes people, if I'm getting ready to preach, and I don't preach every Sunday, it's kind of an occasional thing. We have 7 ministers on our staff, so I get to preach every once in a while. And people go, hey, what's your sermon about for Sunday? What's your sermon about? And I go, and I have to think it back. I says, well, a sermon isn't about anything. I said, a sermon does something. A sermon is something. And that's my understanding of it. A sermon is an encounter, you know. So somebody says, but what's it about? And I go, well, it isn't really about anything. It's about, I preached last Sunday at church, and afterwards I went to a pool party, and somebody said, hey, what was your sermon about today? And I said, love? I mean, what else could it be about? I didn't know what else to say. So, because for me, the event of speaking, especially in a sacred context or a spiritual context, is that there's something going on beyond the words, beyond all the words that I might say. Unless that's all the subject tonight is love, then I'm a noisy clanging gong, you know. And I always tell, I'll step away for a second, that, anyway, I teach speech communication as well, and I always tell my speech students, I said, people believe your bodies before they believe your words. It says 90% of your communication, I just made that number up, but 90% of your communication is happening here, with the body, not the head. Anyway, so I'm behind a podium for tonight, but really, unless this is telling you I love you, nothing else I say will matter. So that's important. That's important for me to say and to communicate. And that's why this is a different animal being up here tonight, you know. It's a Yogi Bear kind of animal, I guess, right? It's a different animal to speak to, so that this idea of what I communicate, the words are words are words are words. You know, I'm a word painter. You know, I know how to do this. But I want to, that's my prayer as we begin, is that unless I emanate that sense of I'm vulnerable and authentic with you here tonight, mostly meaningless, you know. There'll be some nuggets in here too, but that's something like Diana said, and many people, they stand up in front, they say, this is my story, and if something you hear something that doesn't work for you, set it aside. Now, I also want to say that, too, that's not a cop-out in saying that. That gives me license, to feel like it gives me license to say whatever I want. I still want to, I respect you enough to speak in love. And that's a sense of saying, I don't want to say like, oh, you know, that whole thing about yelling fire in a busy, you know, in a packed theater is dangerous speech, you know. And I say that I respect you enough to say that as I walk through this, again, I'll say, let go of what doesn't serve you. Notice it. It's like, ooh, I'm irritated by that, or I'm upset about that. Notice it, breathe through it, you know, ask me about it later. So. But I do want to respect you enough to say that part of this is I grew up the youngest child in a family of four. There were three older girls at that point. And I always knew how my sisters got in trouble. You know, I watched them get in trouble, so I knew how not to, you know. And so I knew how to appear to be behaving myself. And I've done that my whole life. I really have. In most ways, I appear to be behaving myself. And it means that sometimes maybe, yeah, I had to face that. It's like sometimes I'm deceptive, you know. I won't say a lot of things. So as we go through tonight, I mean, it's a real risk for me to balance that between what I say is my truth, and I keep that in balance with. There's this conundrum of what our CFO JFO world is, and I still use CFO word and JFO. So is that I when I want to invite somebody, I have this conundrum. CFO, JFO, it's a little too Christian for some people and not Christian enough for others. Yeah, so like some of you are nodding. We're in this kind of balance between these two things. And so I have this sense of, okay, I want to make sure I appear Christian enough, but also kind of far out, I don't know. So as we go along, you'll get to know Mystic Mike. That's my best category, Mystic Mike. So I'll tell you a little bit about my family. Do we have power here? Okay, there it is. Okay, well, I think we might need to dim that for a second. All right. Oh, that's what as we're doing that, I'll tell you. This question of who am I? And earlier today, I heard a younger person say, I don't know who I am yet. I'm still creating. And I was like, oh, girl, join the club. but what I thought in that sense of, if I go too quickly, raise your hand and say, slow down. When I think of that question of who am I, I'm still learning who I am. But what I do know is that every person I encounter mirrors back to me who I am. And that's both can be in positive and negative ways. You know, if I see you as loving, that says something about myself. And if I see you as irritating, annoying, uptight, stuck in your ways, you're mirroring back from me something about myself as well. So I said, I thought about that in our prayer group today. I was like, wow. Every time I'm annoyed, irritated, upset, angry at somebody else, I'm learning something about myself. But I wanted to hold that in the context of who I am is a journey of discovery, you know, still is. And then that even though it might be an inward journey of discovery, it's also that everything I perceive and every encounter I have, you're telling me who I am. And so for me to be up here, instead of song leading, I feel like I'm up in front of everybody, and that's performance mic, you know, that's performance mode. And to be in this mode is different. It's a lot more risk for me to be vulnerable. And so I appreciate the invitation. And though I'm up here, we're all involved in the encounter. And that's why so when people ask me, what's your sermon about? I would really like to tell them it's about encounter. You know, and for me, I would say it's about an encounter with the divine, with God, with Jesus. Something was some way of saying, in the midst of our conversation, God is sneaky, you know. God slips in and looks us in the face and the heart and opens, you know, there's a chance for something amazing to happen. All right, who am I, though? We'll put that into context. Let's see what we got. What did I choose for you? Did I turn it on? I don't know. Technology. That's magic. Oh, okay. Well, we'll get there. Anybody know what that is? All right, we'll get there. Okay. So, see, that's what I was after, you know. Well, let's go. Let's see. We get back to that one. Okay, here we go. I was born into a family that had three older girls. These three girls were born in Woburn, Massachusetts. All right, yeah. This is somebody raising a hand. Yay, Woburn. They were born in Woburn in the 1960s, and my parents got married in upstate New York, north of Utica, up in the Adirondacks, and yeah. And little towns like Prospect, Remsen, Hinckley Lake. In the 1930s, my parents were born in the 1930s and experienced the Depression. Everyone was poor. But luckily, both my parents, they went to college, and they had known each other since childhood. My mother's brother and my father were best friends. But my mother told me the other day that she and my father didn't start dating until she was out of college, and she was an elementary school teacher. They got married in 1959. They lived in a tent on the Black River. After they got married, you know. And my father tells this great story of, like, my mother went into the tent at one point, and there was a snake in the tent, and she's screaming. My father comes in with a gun and starts shooting the snake and shooting holes in the tent, you know, big army tent. I was like, that's a good story. Oh, the family, right. So they moved to Woburn, Massachusetts. My father got a job with GTE Sylvania. At some point, it was one or the other, and they combined. And so they lived in Woburn, and three girls were born. And when Karen, so that's Christine is the oldest in the middle, Shelley, who was here last year, some of you might know her on the end. Karen is next to me in age. And when she was born in 1964, then they moved to Lompoc, California, at Vandenberg Air Force Base. Somebody else mentioned Vandenberg. Yeah, you did, right. So we were at Vandenberg in the 60s. Right. And so my father worked with the missiles, right? Yeah. And then I always tell people I'm a native Californian because I was conceived there. And then we moved on to Grand Forks, North Dakota. I don't have a picture of that, but Grand Forks, North Dakota, and because of military stuff as well, missiles. And I was born there in December during a blizzard, you know. And there was an appointment for me to be born, you know, because they thought, well, a storm's coming, we better do it, you know. So I was an induced child. Okay, well, let's keep it going. New North Dakota, Grand Forks. 6 months later, we moved to Sudbury, Massachusetts. So we lived there for a year and a half, and then we moved to. Oh, let's go back. We moved to this island, in the middle of the South Pacific. This is Kwajalein. It's a missile tracking range for the military, halfway between Hawaii and the Philippines. It's in the Marshall Islands, which is part of Micronesia. All right, so. This island is 3 miles long. The runway you can see takes up most of the island. And we lived, when we first moved, we lived way up there with the part that was reclaimed from the sea in these trailers. And during hurricane, these all went, the water would come in under, the trailers were up on blocks, but the water would come in. And that's some of my earliest memories are of hurricanes and purple lightning, I don't know why. But just that sense of, oh, back to North Dakota. When I was first born, they brought me home in December, and they had to keep my crib in the middle of the, again, it was army housing in trailers, inside the middle of the room because ice would form on the walls of the trailers. So it was like, you know, rustic living. So this was a pretty idyllic childhood, growing up in a place like this. All you had to do was swim, you know, swim in the ocean and collect shells. In fact, for our first Christmas, we arrived in December. I had my second birthday in Honolulu, and on our way there, and we did get a Christmas tree from the military store, the PX, but there were no ornaments. And so my father, we all collected seashells, and my father, we spray painted them silver, gold, and red, and green, and strung them on ribbon and hung them from the tree. So that was our first Christmas in Kwajalein. My mother was a teacher, and so my mother and I got on a little boat when I was just 3, 4, 5 years old every day, and we went to the next island. You know, where she taught the native people English. And she became the coordinator of the English language studies for the Republic of the Marshall Islands later on in her life. But I recognize that my parents were very service-oriented. My father took a plane to work every day. He worked 90 miles away on another island where they tracked missiles and stuff. So that's childhood. What else have I got for you? Well, so that takes us to, I like this picture. Here I am with it. That's me on a boat, you know, venturing out into the world. And I love that sense of, as a child, I was, at that stage, somewhat fearless. You can't tell from this picture, but I'm covered with chickenpox. And we thought we were on an island called Panape, which was all jungle. And my parents thought it was just mosquito bites, and so they didn't do anything for a while. They finally they got me home, and they're like, not mosquito bites. That's chickenpox. But I like that sense of that. For me, it's a kind of symbolic of venturing out into the world. So let me take you through some of these just quickly. Oops, there we go, the siblings. Flora, Hawaii, as we continue to grow up. This is Needham. Oh, then after Kwajalein, we moved to Needham, Massachusetts. So we lived there from 1973 to 1978. We went to the Carter Memorial United Methodist Church. And do you know, anybody know what the name Carter comes from in Needham? Carter's underwear. Carter underwear. Carter, the original Carter, the mill and the, you know, where they made Carter's underwear. So Carter Memorial United Methodist Church. And then that's somewhat late. My parents' 50th wedding anniversary. The siblings and I. So anyway, I'm gonna leave us with this one. Diana talked about doors. And in our prayer group, we talked about doors. They said, imagine what your door, during our prayer group pep, and what is your door to your inner life? And this image came to mind, and so I found it for us tonight. Now, Tanya, do you recognize that door?
I do, and I can't remember where it's from.
This is in northern Ethiopia, yeah. Tanya and I and Dana went off to Ethiopia last year, along with Malawi and Kenya. I'll tell you more about that story, but we were in Ethiopia, and we traveled high, high into the mountains to a monastery that was up in the hills, and this was the door into the monastery. So that's my door, kind of the door into mystery. What do I have for you? I want to read you a quotation about Glenn Clark and Camps Farthest Out, all right? I found this in a book, was written about 1960, a big thick book like this, and it was called Spirits in Rebellion, and it's the history of the New Thought movement, all right? So, this is a quotation about Glenn Clark, and the man who wrote this was at Southern Methodist University. It's a very scholarly book about the New Thought movement in the first half of the 20th century. And he puts Glenn Clark into a chapter along with Norman Vincent Peale. He says he calls them those orthodox folks who brought New Thought into the Christian church. All right, so just hear that again. He put it in with those folks who stayed with their identity as Christian, but they brought in some of the language of New Thought. But here's this quotation. So he's another one, just after Norman Vincent Peale. He's another one who, being himself, a recognized New Thought leader, has been highly influential in introducing New Thought ideas and techniques into the churches, and this was Glenn Clark. For many years, a member of the faculty of McAllister College, Presbyterian Liberal Arts College in St. Paul, Minnesota, Glenn was a teacher of English and an athletic coach. But he was deeply religious and somewhat of a mystic, a great believer in prayer. He first came into prominence through an article in the Atlantic Monthly, The Soul's Sincere Desire. He then began to be much in demand as a speaker in the churches and in the summer camps. Eventually, he organized a summer camp of his own, to which he gave the name Camps Farthest Out, or The Camps, The Camp Farthest Out. Here, for a period amid pleasant surroundings, a group of congenial and serious-minded persons met for a season of fellowship, relaxation, and the spiritual renewal under the direction of Dr. Clark and others of somewhat similar views. In it all, prayer and the disciplines of silence and meditation have played a major role. He sometimes called the camps laboratories for experimentation in the art of praying. So this goes on. I might share more with you about that. But I thought that was so interesting. This book kind of leapt off the shelf at me when I was in a used bookstore in Seattle, off the coast of Seattle, and poof, there it was. And flipped through, I said, well, I wonder if Glenn Clark's in here. And sure enough, there are like four pages all about him. But I like that. We'll come back to that sense of, I often refer to Glenn Clark as a Protestant mystic. And so we've heard that word kind of bantied around, and a couple people have talked to me and said, what do you think that word means? And I'll do some unpacking of why that category fits for me as well. Let me just wait a couple of... Oh, so as I was preparing for camp, I read A Man's Reach by Glenn Clark, his autobiography. I hadn't read it in a while, but it was great. There's some amazing stuff in here, you know. But here's one little quote when he says about when he was 7 years old. I know I had touched, at the age of seven, a great beam of cosmic consciousness. I had seen a great light. And that light spelled out six luminous words, I and my Father are one. So at 7 years old, he has this sense of, I love that, I had touched a great beam of cosmic consciousness. And that light spelled out, and I'd seen a great light. And that light illumined six words, I and my Father are one. And early on, I was introduced to three great realities, life, death, and creative imagination. So throughout the week, it could have come back to that idea of how important imagination is in the life of faith, or it has been to me. So anyway, I'll bring snippets of that, Glenn Clark. And I want to do say that just at our last camp I was at, Lassen Camp, we're meeting with the young adults. You know, the young adults were struggling. They were all put into adult prayer groups, but they said, we want our own group, you know. And so the council ring met with them and talked, and they struggled, and we talked late into the night about this. And at some point, somebody raised up, they've been in camp for a long time, they said, you know, all that talk about Glenn Clark, I can't relate. I don't understand it. Why you old folks all talk about Glenn Clark, you know. And there was a woman also, just a little younger than me there also, and she said, I understand. She said, people start talking about Glenn Clark, and it gets a little cult-like sounding, and she said, when I was a teenager, I just rolled my eyes and rolled my eyes and rolled my eyes, and she says, and I tried to read his books. I couldn't. I've tried for 30 years. And she said, until recently. She said, I started reading Be Thou Made Whole with a group of people, group of friends, you know, from CFO and JFO, and she goes, I'm starting to like Glenn Clark, you know. So if at any point, you know, if I reference him a little too much, it's not the sense of saying that we hold him up. I hold him up as a lens, as a mirror for myself, and say, oh, I love his creativity and what he has to offer and insights, and to kind of say something that spurs me on to my own spiritual growth. And I think that he would like that as well, a sense of, you know, to spur us on to our own, onto our own path. So what am I doing? Okay, so how did I get to camp? Let's see, I told you we moved to Needham, 1973, 1978. In 1978, after that, what was it that happened in the February of 1978? The blizzard. Rebecca was born and Mr. Belmonte was born, right? 78. 9 months later after the blizzard? Yep, right. what was I going to say? Oh, after the blizzard of 78, my father says, we're moving to Arizona. Yeah. So in 1978, we moved from Needham, Massachusetts to Sierra Vista, Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is on the Mexican border. It's a military base and a town, and it's high in the desert, high mountain, desert mountains. Anyway, it was quite a shock and quite a shift for me, you know, to move from, you know, Needham, Massachusetts, and all those friends, and out to be very isolated. We lived off 6 miles out of town on a canyon road, where the bus would come at 6 o'clock in the morning and pick us up, and then go all the way up into the canyon, pick up all the ranching kids, and then turn around at the Hummingbird Sanctuary. You had to go like this. The bus had to go like, kind of turn around up in the mountain there and come all the way back down. It was a little disconcerting to me and took me years to make friends there in Arizona. One of the things that happened, though, was we were attending the Sierra Vista United Methodist Church, and for a while, I didn't, like, when I turned 11 or 12 or something, I was like, I'm done with church. I don't want any more. If I were in the movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks, you know, Angela Lansbury would sing to me the song The Age of Not Believing, I think. Trust me, it's in there. Okay, I was looking for a little more recognition. Oh, yeah. Anyway, there's a great song in there, The Age of Not Leaving. And that for me was 12 and 13, 14-ish. But then my parents forced me, kicking and screaming. Who was talking about kicking and screaming? Anyway, that was somebody. Kicking and screaming to go to a youth retreat at the church. And the youth retreat was on death and dying, which is like, wow, that's profound. That's a bummer, right? But it was really profound, and it touched me deeply. So people there, they spoke at many different levels of their experience of death. My mother spoke about the death of her brother, you know, and how that challenged her faith. And other people spoke about near-death experiences and seeing light and coming back and saying, it's all beautiful on the other side. And other people there's just lots of talk about death and how to handle it. So actually, in the midst of that, I decided to go back to church. So I was about 15 or 16. And then a new minister came to it was Methodist, so we changed ministers a lot. A new guy came from Southern California or mid-California, and he was a CFO person. And his first year there, he brought three of us youth to La Honda CFO in Northern California, in the Redwoods. And that was his name was Bob Peel, and he was married to Hope Peel at the time. She's gone back to Hope Farr now. Anyway, Bob Peel is the nephew of Norman Vincent Peel. Yeah, there's all these connections, all these things where, like I said, Norman Vincent Peel and Glenn Clark are sometimes discussed in similar ways. And so this guy, this minister, he was so convinced that we would have a great time there. He took us 16 years old. I went to camp, and so Arizona, Southern Arizona to California, and it was a very strange experience again, because these kids were worldly, you know, in that youth group. They talked about cocaine and sex and all kinds of stuff was going on in their lives, and I just was like, wow. It was more than I could take in, but in the midst of that, I really wanted to be with the adults more than I wanted to be with the youth at that time. But anyway, it was such a good experience that I did kept going back. I can't work out the grammar in front of people, but... Right, I did keep, no, no, something. There you go. So let me tell you about a few things that happened at that camp. Oh, where's this list? I found, as I was getting ready to come to camp, I looked through my files, and I found the roster from 1983 of that camp, This is the LaHonda CFO. And so I was reading through it, and I was quite surprised to see some of the names, and you might recognize some of them. This is just, if you're new to all of this, just take a nice deep breath, and okay. First name on the list is Lucille Anderson. And so I think she was the rhythms leader that year, possibly. Let me pick out a few here. The Buells, Sean Buell. Sean Buell was 11 at that time, and he was my little buddy. We were assigned little buddies. So I remember carrying Sean Buell around on my shoulders all through the camp and everything. Up, dum, 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 dum. Dan Damon was there. So you've heard some of his music here, but he was there not as the piano player, but just an attendee. Marilyn Dunham. Marilyn Dunham was there. And for those of you who don't know her, she was diagnosed in April with a brain tumor. And she's been in camps all these years, incredibly spiritual person. The doctors told her, it says, it's inoperable, but we could do this, 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 and this. And she just looked at him and she said, no, thank you. And she and her husband, Mac, she says, we're going to go home and I'm going to do this my way. You know, we're going to do this our way. We're going to do it God's way. And she went home and Diane was with her when she passed. Diane Bush, I think, you know, my best friend. Diane Bush, anyway, she was there to help them pass. And she passed a couple of weeks ago, really, right? Yeah. Yeah. And but she did, I want to ask Diane about it. It's a beautiful experience. She decided to go do it her way. So I've known Diane for 35 years. Dave Gaddy was the speaker that year, one of the speakers. Abigail and Sarah Gessler, the Gutfelts, some of these, the Napstad family, Gloria, Marta, Sig, and Kari. Who else? Look who's here, Wally and Dorothy Olson. So who is that, Denby? Mommy and Daddy, right, yeah. Let's see, anything else? Some of these names might be meaningful to you, but Jim and Barbara Thomas. Barbara Thomas was a speaker that year, okay? I'll tell you a little story about that. Jim and Barbara, Margaret Thrasher. Steve Thrasher, her son, was 6 years old at the time, and he's speaking right now at Pacific Redwoods Camp. That camp is overlapping with us. And so Stephen, who was 6 years old that year, is now speaking. Let's see. Da-da-dum. And John Thomas, who was is Tanya's uncle. And he was 19 at the time, and he had a multicolored mohawk like this, you know. He was a wild man. Okay, and there's a couple other people I'll tell you about. But one of my first experiences of camp, you know, it's all, and for those who come for the first time, it's all kind of new and strange. But one of the interesting things was that Barbara Thomas, when she was speaking, she would be talking for a while, and then she'd just get quiet. Oh, okay, thank you. All right. And then she would go on speaking. You know, she was like, she had this inner dialogue with God, and she would just, you know, say, she would just tune in. And she told us, this is my process for this speaking time. So I'm just going to get quiet and listen to what I'm to share with you right now and share with you. So I was just kind of like, wow. That was kind of something. But the entire program was meaningful to me. I mean, at 16 years old, it's hard to describe for you. You may know. But for yourself, the depth of depression that I was in at 16 years old, self-loathing, I did not like myself, you know, at all. It was deep. And 6 months before camp, that minister that brought us, Bob Peel, gave me Agnes Sanford's book, The Healing Light. And that book became very meaningful to me, and still is. The concepts in there, the sense of praying with light, visualizing light and seeing it surrounding people and situations and trusting it. And it was an amazing thing to begin to let light into that darkness, you know. And so I come to camp, and the singing was great because I was a singer. I was like, oh my gosh, singing is great. And the rhythms, I loved rhythms and all of it. I just kind of fully embraced it all. Youth group was tough because I was with lots of these kids I didn't know, but we worked our way into it. Lots of prayer. And so I can tell you a couple of experiences. And I think they happened this first year or the second year. And I want to lift up a couple of those. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to do them fast. Okay. A couple of experiences that happened that first year. One of them was rhythms. And Lucille Anderson was leading. And she had one of those moments where she was playing classical music and gave everybody, you got to pick a piece of cloth, and you're just moving with the cloth and moving with the cloth. And something let go in me that I just started moving and just started dancing and kind of like moving and moving and moving. And there was a woman there, her name was Isla Rogers, and she became Isla Reynolds later on. And the two of us did this amazing, she was a dancer, I mean, just kind of ballet, swirling and swooping around this band shell. And I was a mind out of body experience for me, completely letting go to rhythms. And so for me, my very first rhythms, I feel like I got it. You know, I got what it was all about. It was just to live it, do it with abandon, complete and utterly, not even caring what anybody was. And it was so, it released me from so much. And it was really powerful. So I treasure that memory because it allowed me to say, that's what praying with the body is about. Praying with one's whole being, because it's about letting go so completely in, you know, into God that all the thoughts that get in the way of praying just are gone. And it allowed me to see that I am beautiful. And by the end of camp, people came up to me and they said, you know, when you came to camp, you couldn't stand up straight. You know, I'm like, you know, I didn't know. And they said, do you notice that here at the end of camp, you're standing up straight? I do have to tell you that I have struggled with depression and shame and guilt and all those things that have weighed me down still all my life to this day. So I'm still working on that, still letting the light in. And but that set me on this journey. Another thing that happened, there's a woman, I didn't tell you her name, but her name is Claire Galalian. And I only met her that once. I did meet her many years later. But this one, she was at camp. And towards the end of the camp, so you have to understand, you know, CFO, at that time, this is 1983, you know, we're already beginning to make some shifts into some very camps that would be fundamentalist, speaking in tongues. There's some, and those that are kind of going more, you know, metaphysical, for whatever categories we use, a little more loosey-goosey, a little more uptight. I don't know what it is, but just kind of going different directions. And so I came into it at a time when some of these splits are already happening. But at this camp, it was there were people that spoke in tongues there. They'd pray for you in tongues. There are all kinds of things, all kinds of people. But Claire came up to me, and I didn't know her, and she just said, I kind of have to move out to do it.
Claire comes to me, and she's Claire's kind of got that airy fairy kind of a accoutrement, all the scars. Okay, so she comes to me, and she's like, "You're not from this world. You have come to bring a message of love."
You're not from this world. Yeah, 16-year-old who's got all kinds of identity issues, you know. You're not from this world. You have come to bring a message of love to all humanity, you know. The message is always love. And that remains my challenge. I said, whatever that was. I met her like 15 years later. And I said, Claire, do you remember this time and you said this? And she's like, no. And so, but for whatever that was, I take it as a sense of anytime I'm not acting in love. And this
isn't communicating love to you and everybody else.
I'm outside of my purpose. I really am. And okay, got to come on this. So that's why tonight I start with that really profound message that's so much more than it means so much more than in the context of weddings, that chapter on love, you know, because it's really a profound chapter. And that's a sense of, so when I say anytime I notice that I'm irritated with another person, upset or afraid, I'm afraid of people all the time. I mean, I know I have to go, huh, what is that saying about me, you know? And so my being up here, I'm calm, cool, and collected when I do this. I'm a professional, but I'm just a joke. So, I mean, but to be here, to be vulnerable, and to do this, it was a stretch for me. I don't know why, but I really struggled with this. And so much of this might be like a watercolor painting, Matisse, who's impressionist painting. So sometimes it kind of comes across as an impressionist painting. You get stories, you get to all weave it together. But one of the most, so why mystic fits with me even more than being told, you're not from this planet. Like Ian said during Rhythms Today, all the aliens into the center. I was like, here I go. Right, there are a lot of aliens there this morning, right. If you weren't there, you missed it. Okay, so. What was I saying? Oh, one of the things that happened at camp is with those youth group, like we're like doing all kinds of wild and crazy things, running through the hills in the redwoods, you know, these big kind of grassy hills surrounded by redwoods. And we would go out at night and we'd just like take off onto the hills. And at one point I got completely separated from the group. And I'm new at camp. I don't know anything. I'm like, I'm in the dark, in the redwood forest, in a place I don't know. And you have to understand is I, to that point in my life, was terrified of the dark. Just terrified. Outside, inside, everything, dark. It was a big symbol for me. So here I am in the dark, and I lost, disconnected from everybody. And I'm like, what do I do? I don't remember what I prayed, but I said, God, show me the way. And the path lit up with light from where I was all the way back to camp. And there was no way I could even see that path because it would have crossed, you know, down, you know, there was no physical way I could have even seen it if the moon hit it at some special way. There was no physical way I could have seen it, but all of a sudden I could see the entire path lit up with light. And I was like, whoa. And so I followed the path back to camp. And those kinds of experiences are rare, but they happened. I mean, all of that happened in my first year of camp, and that's like something unique and special is here. And the thing I always say about camp is I say, camp loved me into being. And who am I? You know, I'm a reflection of all of those who have loved me and love each other. And so that's what I hold for us this week, is how can we continue to love one another into being more fully? And I hold on to that image of Christ in me, you know, is for me, that's a very powerful and important image. The Christ in me is that light, the light of life. And I hold on to that. And I hold that for us, if that's meaningful to you, so that we can love each other into being and this in an encounter with the divine in the midst. So love, love, love. Love, 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 love. All you need is love. I don't know. I was trying to think. It's a cross between the Beatles song and something else. Right, right. All you need, da, da, da. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Love. Da, 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 da. Okay, that was my profound moment for the evening. And 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. So let's move into our evening prayer. And if this is new to you, we use two parts of a prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Then we shift over to let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me.